We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Welcome to Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. On today's episode, spaces that are more than meets the eye. Welcome to Potterversity. On today's episode, we're talking with Elizabeth Baird Hardy about spaces that are more than meets the eye. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, Director of Campus Ministry at Ohio Dominican University and author of several Harry Potter essays and co-editor with Katie of Potterversity.
Emily, congratulations on the new post.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited about it.
That's awesome. Ohio small colleges.
Yay. Yes, for the win.
Right. Yeah. Today we're going to be talking about ways that exteriors sometimes mask the true nature of interiors that can be more than what they seem in the wizarding world, Harry Potter and Fantastic Beasts, and within fantasy series in general. We'll take a little step outside to how we see this in other series too. Emily, have you ever had the experience of being deceived by what appeared to be a small outside, only to find a vast inside?
I'm sure I have in many metaphorical ways in my life, but since I started my new job this week, I will say, yeah, my little campus here in Columbus is a small place, and you know, I've been there a few times, and it seemed really quiet. I think I was there in the summer, you know, interviewing and getting to know the place, and then you know, this fall, you know, it all of a sudden seems like a much bigger place. I've met, you know, so many new people, and it's bustling with all these students. It has a lot of athletic programs, so all the students look very fit. And so it's interesting. It's just like, you know, everywhere you turn, there's a little group of people, and you're like, oh, they have a whole little world here, you know, that I'm just learning. And so that's my experience. Do you have any?
That's a great example. Mine is a little more Hermione's bag than 12 Grimmauld Place. I first thought of an experience I had with my youngest son, Griffin, when he was very small. He was probably 3 years old, something like that. And we'd come back from the park and he wanted to show me a rock that he had collected because he's like his dad, loves the rocks. And like he dug into the little tiny pocket of his little tiny shorts. And then he started pulling out rock after rock after rock after rock after rock. I was like, oh my God, where are all these rocks coming from? Like, what's going on? You're like, how did you fit all those rocks in those little tiny pockets, in those like toddler pants? So I was thinking about like how I felt, which was, you know, astonishment, but it was also delightful and funny to think about it. I mean, it was like clowns coming out of a clown car, you know,
right.
Where you're like, where are they all coming from? But I was sort of thinking about that when I was reading the chapter about deceptively small exteriors for today's episode.
I love it.
Joining us for our discussion today is Elizabeth Baird Hardy, who teaches English and Humanities at Mayland Community College in Western North Carolina. She's the author of Milton, Spencer, and the Chronicles of Narnia, and has contributed to scholarly collections on subjects as varied as Harry Potter, The Hunger Games, and Star Trek. She has been a contributor to the Hogwarts Professor blog for over 14 years and always enjoys the opportunity to chat about literature. Today, we're specifically chatting about her recent chapter published in Lana Whited's The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond. And her chapter is titled Muggle-worthy, Deceptive Exteriors and Outsized Interiors in the Wizarding World. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. So thank you very much for inviting me today.
Well, I'm excited for you to walk us through this. You know, I'm interested in space and time and how that's all sort of like fungible in this wizarding world space. And so I loved your chapter and I'm so excited to talk more with you about it, especially because you have such a, you know, you know so much about other, you know, fantasy worlds and how they're doing similar things. So let's just start with Hogwarts, though. You say there is an implicit lesson in the Hogwarts curriculum: do not trust architecture. How are students learning that lesson at Hogwarts and in the wizarding world in general?
Well, and of course, that's one of the reasons why we have Harry's point of view that we see. The wizarding children already know that lesson. They live in houses that are like that. They have been to Diagon Alley. The children who have grown up in wizarding homes understand that. It's only a child like Harry who is surprised to get this letter revealing that he is in fact a wizard, so that we as the readers then travel along with him and discover that the staircases move at Hogwarts, that when we go to Diagon Alley, that tiny little opening, which I love looking at how many ways how many ways we see that the leaky cauldron is small and the opening is small, and then all of the all the descriptions change as we get into Diagon Alley and suddenly everything's big and spacious. So no one is surprised about that except for students like Harry who have never been exposed to it before. And of course Hermione isn't surprised, even though she didn't grow up in a wizarding household, because she already read and memorized Hogwarts history, so she's totally prepared when she gets there.
The importance of research.
Absolutely. Preparing for the trip. And you can see, I mean, I love that about, because Harry and Hermione are the two people we have all gone on a trip with. The one person who has everything packed for days, everything's totally prepared, everything's ready to go. And then there's the other one, we're leaving today. So, that's Harry, we're leaving today. No previous research. So that's that wonderful kind of experience that we get as the readers, because normally in our world, or as we hear about another piece of architecture in another book, that when things are there, they're there all the time. But in the wizarding world, that's not true. And so that experience for us as readers comes through Harry, and that idea that we go to a building where paintings turn into doorways, where staircases aren't there. There's a door that goes one place today, and then on Thursdays it goes someplace else. So there's that wonderful experience, which is delightful for readers of all ages to imagine that maybe that place that we go, maybe it's not going to go there today. maybe when I open this door, it will be into a clean room instead of the untidy room that I suspect is behind it.
Yeah, really changes your view of the kind of mundane day-to-day expectations, right? Anything could happen.
Right.
Well, what is the purpose of all these exteriors that don't match the interior, you know, both within the story and in terms of the effect that it has on the reader?
Well, it has, of course, practical purposes, because we can have a building that things move around, and that creates all sorts of narrative possibilities, which is very handy. Something like the Room of Requirement, which is a wonderful narrative invention that just does, it's like, we need a room that does this. Fantastic. We have a room that can do anything. And it's like so many other tools that authors of speculative fiction of any kind use, this idea that I need something that does this. And in a world where I can make up some of the rules, then I can do that. So we need spaces that are flexible. We need malleable interiors. So certainly has that narrative purpose. We need those things to happen. And it adds to that wonderful sense, that idea that we are escaping the mundane, that we have gone to a different world where we are not confined by those same old things. And so it creates that sense of wonder that we could open that door and there could be something wonderful or something terrible behind it at any moment. But it also really adds to the overall idea of the books that we can't always trust appearances. We have characters who are like that. And right from the very beginning, we have Hagrid, who's terrifying. And yet here is soft-hearted, sweet Hagrid, who it's a good thing that there is not an animal shelter right next door to Hogwarts, because, you know, he would have every animal there, you know, except for cats, because, of course, he's allergic, which is funny. I love that he's allergic to cats, which is the only thing, I think, preventing him from being like the Wizarding World equivalent of the crazy cat lady with five cats.
Yeah, for sure.
because he absolutely, they would be, and they would definitely be like scary cats. They wouldn't be like regular, ordinary house cats. So we have sweet, sweet Hagrid. And then we have other people who look nice, like Professor Umbridge, who are in fact horrible. So we have all of these things that, it's this reminder that we can't always trust our senses. And so sometimes it's what's happening inside our heads that's more real than what we see in front of us. And that is reinforced by those in buildings and architectural features that change from time to time throughout the series.
So one of the things I find really interesting about the way this works in the Harry Potter universe is that some of these spaces seem like they're sensitive to emotional or psychological factors. I think about how you have to like notice the leaky cauldron, for example, right. And you have to want something in the Room of Requirement. What does it mean that this kind of psychological or emotional component is a part of the magic of these spaces?
If we think about visiting, for example, a relative's house, a place we've been, especially if we have positive childhood memories there, we are going to experience that space differently than a stranger. And then if we go back to that space, let's after that relative has passed away and the house is empty and it's different, a stranger is going to see, oh, here's a space. Oh, we could move this furniture around. We could redecorate. We are seeing furniture that used to be there and people that used to be there. We see a different space because we are invested differently. And I actually, as you were sharing your experiences, I had this experience just over the past weekend. I went back to a house I never expected to revisit, and it was hard because there were little children running through this house, my cousin's children, who that I ran through that house 40 years ago, but it was so different. And I saw it so different when I was that child. So even in the Muggle world, spaces change based on how we feel about them. So, you know, we've all been to places that seemed perfectly harmless until something bad happened while we were there. And so that there's that idea that somehow the way that we regard the world is deeply affected by our experience. So why wouldn't it in the magical world, and even be more so in the fact that, so the Room of Requirement knows that you need a bathroom. So they're all the chamber pots. It's not like sophisticated. It's not like a really nice bathroom. You
know? How about a proper toilet? There's no bidet.
And we have indoor plumbing at Hogwarts. So why is it a bathroom? So that just fascinates me. But that idea that somehow the spaces can be affected by how we feel about them is entirely plausible. If there were a magical world, of course, the way we think and feel about it is going to affect the way that the world manifests in front of us.
That is so interesting. And it makes me think of two things. And the first thing is my grade school.
Absolutely.
I went back to my grade school. My mom taught at my grade school. And I think maybe I went back on the occasion of her retirement or something. I was helping her move out or something. And I hadn't been there probably for 7 or 8 years. Mm-hmm. And I walked in the door and everything felt like it had shrunk.
Absolutely.
Because I was a foot taller or a foot and a half taller since the last time I had been there. And it was the weirdest feeling. I walked around that whole building, the gym, the cafeteria, her room, my old classrooms, and everything felt like it had been miniaturized in, you know, or just shrunk in a way. It was so weird. And the other thing that it makes me think of is, I don't know what the name of the documentary is, but it's some documentary that J.K. Rowling participated in, was interviewed for and everything, and they took her back to that apartment in which she lived with her daughter, her oldest daughter, and wrote the first parts of Harry Potter, and she was just in tears. I mean, she was just walking around that place in tears, remembering those times, and it was really moving. It was really moving to watch how the space, like you said, was affecting her, and it was kind of almost triggering to her to feel these strong emotions, just walking through it.
It's so interesting you use the elementary school example, because I always use that in class when I help students in a literature class understand point of view. That's always the example I use, is returning to the elementary school. And, you know, did the building change? No, you changed. And right. And then I always quote from a magician from another universe that I know Emily visits quite frequently, that a great many of the truths to which we cling depend on our own point of view. The great philosopher and literary critic Obi-Wan Kenobi has it all up there very nicely. But our point of view changes. And so, yes, the elementary school is a perfect example of that. So it just makes perfect sense that then a magical school is just going to step it up to the next level.
So one of the things I think about, you know, especially with that particular example, is when we're thinking about a book that is, you know, it's a children's story or what have you, but we know a lot of adults have really loved reading Harry Potter, you know, present company absolutely included. But it makes me think about how it's maybe reversing that. Mm. You know, it's giving us an opportunity to see something that's not smaller than we had thought, but larger than we thought. And maybe it's like a return to childhood. It's a return, a return to a past that, you know, was maybe, I don't know. I don't know if I want to say more innocent, but where we were able to see things in a way that they're bigger than what they would appear to us as adults.
Well, it's less encumbered with baggage, and not baggage like Newt's or Hermione's, but we have a lot less dramatic baggage in that childhood, for sure.
Yes, and I just also want to say, Katie, that I think that that is a really important thing for adults to do on a regular basis for having a healthy social-emotional life. And I think that too often outsiders to, you know, children's literature, especially for, you know, adults or children's literature studies, you know, will say, oh, that's not a good instinct. You shouldn't be returning to childish things, you know. But I think it's so important for us to do this, to reconnect with that childlike perspective. And I just want to advocate for doing so.
Well, let's talk about the room of requirement, because this is a space I find really interesting. And I've looked at it in terms of quantum physics and how something, you know, at the quantum level, particles can exist in many states at once until you look at them, and then they like settle into one particular state. And I think of the room of requirement in that kind of way. But you are also interested in the room of requirement, particularly in comparison to some of the other spaces like St. Mungo's or Diagon Alley or 12 Grimald Place. How is the room of requirement, how is it different in terms of Wizarding World spaces?
Well, I love that idea about it being different at the atomic level, because that explains something about it. And obviously we know that physics and chemistry at Hogwarts, we call different things. We call them transfiguration, and we call them potions. But we do still have the sciences. Certainly we just have different words for them. But when we go to St. Mungo's, it's always the same place inside there. It doesn't change when we go. Well, there may be some stranger people in the lobby. But a Diagon Alley, it's, you know, the shops only change because maybe, you know, we're putting out some different displays in the windows, or you know, something closed up, as it does throughout the course of the series. But it doesn't intrinsically change. But the room of requirement does. It changes size, it changes shape, it changes purpose. It can be tiny, it can be vast, and it's directly connected to that kind of the reaction of the participant. It's almost like an architectural boggart. It takes, you know, because the boggart can read your mind. The boggart knows what scares you. Diagon Alley cannot read your mind. And it's a good thing, because it's kind of, it's kind of like, you know, when you're just thinking, I want to go on and shop for some shoes, and you're just thinking it. And it comes up on your social media feed. Look, shoes on sale.
Yes.
So can you imagine if that power were turned loose in the Wizarding World on Diagon Alley? You know, everything suddenly goes on sale right there next to you, and you know, it knows you're on a diet, and there are those gorgeous ice cream cones. It knows that you shouldn't be eating that. Of course, the shop owners know what's on all the shopping lists for the kids at Hogwarts. So they're definitely playing to the market there. But yes, let's all be thankful that we don't have stores that are quite that intuitive. It's almost like I used to joke it was terrible, but we had this lovely little neighbor that I used to shop for some, and I used to love to do it, not only because I enjoyed doing something nice for her, but because I like to use my rewards card at the grocery store, because it would completely mess up the algorithm.
Yes.
Because the algorithm is thinking, why does this woman buy cigarettes and dog food only like 4 or 5 times a year? That's so strange.
Right. You're sticking it to the man.
Yeah. So love it. That's my little moment of rebellion there against the AI machine. But the realm of requirement, it's almost like a boggart, because a boggart can sense what scares us, and it turns into that. It knows what you're afraid of, whether it's a desk job. Poor Newt's desk job. I just love that. You know, whatever it is that terrifies you. The room of requirement is like the flip side. And I've often wondered, I'm like, somewhere back in the origins of magic in the wizarding world, did those two kind of spring from the same source? The boggart's like the dark side of what the room of requirement becomes, which is, instead of creating what terrifies you, it gives you exactly what you need. And so it knows, even if it is a little strange, like chamber pots instead of a fully functioning restroom. I don't know. Maybe I always thought that was maybe even a little joke on the part of the room of requirement, because Dumbledore says he didn't know it. We know he doesn't always tell us the truth, but we know that, it's almost like the room of requirement is saying, oh, now you show up. Okay, fine. All you're getting are chamber pots. You know, that's it. But
yeah. And speaking of Dumbledore not always telling the truth, mm-hmm. like, he's pretty cagey mm-hmm. about what he knows about the room of requirement. Like, do we think he's being cagey? Am I just assuming that? Or do we think he actually doesn't know or isn't as familiar with the room as Harry and Draco? Or what's going on there?
I have often wondered about that when he lets that little cute, you know, I found this room full of chamber. It's mm-hmm. it's just like, it's just party talk. And it's just this, you know, like, funny, it's party potty talk, appropriately enough. And it's just like the funny little thing that you'd say, like we'd say something at school. Like we said, you know, the other day at the college, I discovered that we have a ping pong table in storage. Where did that happen? You know, it's just like one of those weird things that you would just share at a, you know, faculty lunch or something. But as with almost everything with Dumbledore, it's just like, as with Rowling, nothing is wasted. It's not, we don't have throwaways. This is going to come mm-hmm. back later and be something important.
Right.
And so, you know, when he throws that out there, how intentional is it? And how truthful is he about not knowing what it does? I think he knew what it did. I think he always knew. But that he needed Harry to find out for himself, because that's the whole point of the Room of Requirement. You have to be able to discover it for yourself. And I've often wondered how much he knew about Draco's use of that room. I think I suspect he knew that too.
Yeah, I concur. And I wonder if it has also to do with the power of the magic in the room. And maybe part of the magic is because, I think about the way they're using the Room of Requirement, mm-hmm. especially to train, you know, to be the Defense Association, and how they needed a secure space mm-hmm. where they, you know, and eventually, you know, they get interrupted by the Inquisitorial squad. But you know, for a long time, it's a safe space. Mm-hmm. It's a secure space. And I wonder if Dumbledore knows that that's an important part of what the room offers, and doesn't want either boy really to know how much he does know about it. Because I just can't imagine that he doesn't know everything there is to know about it.
Emily, like on the flip side, Draco is also using it, but to practice his dark arts and to kind of open the vanishing cabinet so that, you know, figure out how to do that so that, you know, the intruders can come into to Hogwarts. And so it's you know, in that way that a technology can be used for good or for evil, you know, it's similarly a little bit morally neutral mm-hmm. in the way the Room of Requirement functions.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Elizabeth, what do you think about that in terms of, like, what, you know, how the Room of Requirement is responding to Draco compared to how it's responding to Harry in ways that are maybe somewhat similar?
Well, it's interesting, as I was joking a little about AI, which is kind of the basilisk that those of us in academia are fighting right now.
Good metaphor.
Oh, it's just awful. But I heard someone at a workshop recently say that AI is like a really, really not very smart assistant that is working for you and wants to please you and will tell you whatever it thinks you want, even if it's not true. So that's mm-hmm. why if you ask AI, one of the examples I saw someone else use, which I thought was wonderful, was that if you ask it, who has the record for walking across the English Channel, presumably without the aid of magic. It will come up with a person and a date and a time and a place and all this information, which is, of course, completely bogus,
right?
Because that never happened. But it's trying to make you happy. And so it's that idea that of the room of requirement wants to give you what, but the room of requirement doesn't judge the asker. The room of requirement doesn't try to determine anybody's motives. It just gives you what you want. So it is a morally neutral space, even if it is less terrifying than the boggart in terms of what it provides. Its motives may be a little bit more altruistic, but it's definitely not making any moral judgments about who it helps or what it gets. I mean, if you walked in there and said, I need something that will allow me to do something terrible, I want to hurt all these people, and so give me a tool, give me a weapon to do that, it would, because that's what it does. But the people in the room, and so that's, you know, you think how different that room would look if it were a hideout for the Slytherins instead of for the Neville's merry band of rebels there and in the end. So, it's very different based on the motivation of the people who are there.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I always wonder, like, what happens to the space of the Room of Requirement, you know, that had all of the stuff in it, the place where lost objects are found, something like that. And what happens after it all was burned? Like, was that for real? Like, did those things really burn?
Back,
Could they come back if somebody needed or wanted that? I don't know how we help. I think it's intended to be permanent, but I'm not. I don't know that I could say that for sure.
Maybe it just has to start over. It's just like any other space. You clean this closet out, 5 minutes later, it needs to be cleaned again.
It won't take long.
Clutter right back up.
Well, what about the portable, extendable spaces like Hermione's beaded bag or Newt's commander's suitcase? How do these spaces reflect the important details about these two characters? That's a point you make in your chapter, that they reflect their owners. And so I love that. So tell us more about that.
Well, it's really fun because in all my years of working with the Harry Potter books, people have always asked me, surely you want something from these books. It's the time turner, isn't it? I'm like, no, do you see how poor stressed out poor Hermione is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
thing?
No way. Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that's interesting because I think, I do not want more hours in the day. I'll just fill them up with more things to do. But her bag, certainly, especially with what is definitely some sort of charm, probably the one that Harry wanted to use on his trunk when he was running away, that makes it light enough to carry with all her stuff in it. Boy, I would love that bag. That would be fantastic because I'm always carrying much too much stuff and my bag is not magical. It's heavy.
Yeah,
but
me too.
The idea that, we all do. It's the I think it's like the bane of female academia. It's like, we all have that sort of, like Hermione, it's like, we feel you, we know what you're going through. But the idea that, of course, Newt's bag, like him, his case, it's sort of battered and scruffy on the outside, and it looks kind of innocuous. The most magical thing in there to muggle eyes is that scarf, and they don't know what a Hufflepuff scarf looks like. So they just think he's a funny little striped scarf. So, nothing in there is obviously magical when he has his muggle-worthy setting on. But, of course, once you open it up, it is vast and it is full not only. And one of the things I love about that space, it's different. The beaded bag, we can't go inside. Nobody goes into the beaded bag, although we could make a case that we take the tent out and then we go in the tent and all sorts of strange layers that happen there. But we have that case that actually becomes this entry point to all of these different ecosystems where Newt provides everything needed for his beloved creatures. So it certainly reflects his character, his caring. He's not good with people. Newt is not good with people. That's one of the things I loved about the way he is done in the films is how beautifully Eddie Redmayne does with eye contact and lack thereof, because Newt is he doesn't make eye contact because he's and that's also with animals, you have to be careful with that anyway. So he's always awkward with humans, fabulous with animals. So his space in which he can actually enter and get away from human beings and just be with the animals and have everything they need certainly reflects his character as somebody who doesn't want to be in an office. And so it's not a tight enclosed space. It's all these beautiful open spaces down there. And then it's also a space that allows him to provide the needs for all of these creatures that are so near and dear to his heart. And then Hermione, I think, is doing a great little I think her little trick there by using this little ultra feminine bag, she is really sticking it to the patriarchy there, you know. You know, she's saying, oh yes, well, underestimate me, will you? All right, watch this. Mm-hmm. So this is her way of saying, oh, here's my darling little bag, and I'm just so small and frail and fragile.
Right, just the lipstick.
Just a compact and a dollar. You know, that's all that's in there. And I think that's one of the things that frustrates, is always frustrated every one of us. We've all had that experience of, okay, I don't want to have a bunch of stuff in my hands. And so, you know, and that is why we all love dresses with pockets, right? It has big, deep pockets. Like if I need rocks. I need one for rocks and one for salamanders. You know, I need things to go in my pockets. So it certainly reflects Hermione's sense of rebelling against the expectations of the world around her, both in the wizarding world and in the muggle world, that she is her own person, but that she knows how to play the game, and she knows how to hide behind that and use that as a way to do what needs to be done. And of course, it is incredibly organized. You know, I love that when her books fall over in there and she's frustrated, like, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding me. The books are stacked in alphabetical order. My mother's spice cabinet is arranged alphabetically. And it's you've got to be kidding me.
Smart, though.
Yeah, it is smart. It's so strange. It's like, that is really odd. But Hermione's things are in there, you know, so orderly, so tidy. She is just like her mind, you know, it is just so organized and so tidy. So it's beautiful how those packages reflect them as not only as tools for them to use, but as characters.
Yeah, I love that idea, what you said, you know, that a person is much more, right, than what they look like on the exterior, and the capaciousness of the mind, and that the mind can contain so many things. And both Hermione and Newt are characters who could be underestimated, overlooked, and they are frequently in the series as well. And these extendable spaces are kind of a metaphor for how really a lot is going on within their own minds that is rich and, you know, multi-layered.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so you connect this playful extension of space in the Wizarding World to other magical series, including Discworld, Mary Poppins, which I love, the carpet bag, right? Yes. And Narnia. What does this literary tradition tell us about this kind of magic? You know, that this is not just an invention of one series or another, but it really pops up in a lot of different imaginative worlds.
I love the way that Rowling describes her writing process as involving this compost heap, that everything she's ever read, everything she's ever experienced kind of just goes in the pile. And as a person who loves composting and seeing, you know, I have the best pumpkin I grew this year was not one I planted. It was in the compost. It was
a seed in the compost. Absolutely.
It's the prettiest pumpkin. Uh-huh. And I thought about that. But sometimes the neatest ideas are those ones you didn't intend. You didn't know. And so there's so many things that come through in her writing that are clearly the product of her just kind of marinating in all of these traditions, these ideas, because we have bags like this. The bag that Medusa's head is stuffed into is like that. I know it goes way back, because there is that human need to kind of defy our limitations and to think, you know, as humans, we have two hands. We can only carry so much stuff. And so we have to, you know, we come up with different things, whether it was inventing the wheel so we could pull it all behind us. But we're all trying to kind of see how we can contain our world and carry what we need with us. So it's something that's a very basic human need and it comes through in folklore and literature and all these different places. But it's always fun to see how it manifests in different traditions. And one of the things I had the most fun with was thinking about Santa and then the opposite of Santa, of course, with Krampus, you know, cramming children in the bag and then Santa pulling good things. You know, a bag that can hold anything can be just like the Room of Requirement, a tool for good or evil. Are we going to stuff things in there and hide them and, you know, steal things? Or are we pulling things out to be generous and give to everyone around us? So I love the way that this, you know, manifests in all these different places. And the luggage in Discworld is just great because it's so funny. It has feet and it's just so weird and offbeat, like everything in Terry Pratchett is like, it just fits that world so beautifully.
And it has its own personality. You also mentioned like it can fight for, you know,
his teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah. It eats bad guys.
It makes me want to read the series.
Oh yeah.
Your description.
Yeah, and there's so many of those. So if you just need to start with one, I recommend the We Free Men. That's a great one to start with. That's a lot of fun. Where we have the Pixies, but it's Pictsies. So they're like little miniature, pugilistic Scotsmen.
Yeah.
They're just great. And they're painted blue and they got this red hair and they're just fabulous. So I love the We Free Men, and Lords and Ladies is a good time too. So they're all wonderful. And then of course we have fabulous Mary Poppins. And I remember the first time I saw Mary Poppins and watching that arm go on down. That is the greatest bag in the world. Everybody needs that bag. So the she just keeps pulling things out and it doesn't seem to faze her at all. But that great idea of, you know, Mary Poppins, you know, continuing to pull things out, but they're so funny, you know, it's this funny lamp and it's a rubber tree plant that she pulls out of there. She could get anything out of that bag. And of course, Narnia, which is, one very near and dear to my heart. And that's where, the Pevensies, when they're trying to figure out what is going on with Lucy, and they go to see the professor and they make that very logical statement that when things are there, they are there all the time. And the professor, you know, says, you know, really? And so that seems like such a logical thing to say. But as we know from our things like studies of quantum physics, things that are not there all the time. We know that. And we also know that from, thinking just about feelings, you know, do we always feel the same way? Do we always, things change with our perception and with, you know, the way that quantum physics works. So we know that those ideas that somehow things do change, it's everywhere. But this literary tradition tells us this is a kind of magic that really is very near and dear to who we are as humans, that we are always kind of seeking ways in which to contain things. We can only hold so much. I was having this conversation with my daughter recently about forgetting, about memory, and this idea, and of course we saw this with things like Inside Out, that you can only hold so many memories that you can't hold all the memories. And sometimes we wish we could get rid of some memories, you know, we could choose which memories we were going to keep. But the idea of humans that we want to hold on to everything, we can't do that even with our choices in life. We have to make a choice. We have to pick one road or the other, as Robert Frost tells us. We cannot stand there at the crossroads forever, and we can't choose both roads. So as human beings, this idea of choice is really hard for us. And the magical solution would be, you don't have to choose. You can throw everything in the bag, or you can have all the possibilities. And so I think that idea, as well as that desire for there to be something beyond the mundane, those are very strong motivators that are certainly woven throughout literature and folklore and our role as human beings in the world.
Yeah, that's just great. As Elizabeth, I've also because I've written a lot about the kind of sacramental identity, you know, the themes and the various motifs in Harry Potter that really point to the Christian tradition, and especially the Christian sacramental tradition.
Absolutely.
And one of you said a couple of times in your chapter that, you know, some of these things, you know, defy the known laws of physics, you know, and that's exactly, I've been writing about the food in Harry Potter and how it's really kind of points in a very Christian way to the Eucharist, and how this, and it's that same notion of defying our understanding. You know, the Eucharist defies our understanding of what, you know, how material works. Like, you can't just have this unending supply of material that just, you know, at every Mass there's more Eucharist. So how does that, you know, how does that work? Well, it's not according to our normal laws of physics. And I think you do see, especially with this emphasis on the interior of the thing sort of being more, I don't know if I want to say more important, I just want to say more. It's just more than the exterior of the thing. And that's, you know, I said this in our conversation with Louise Freeman recently, that's a theme for the whole series, you know, where Harry has to finally figure out that what's on the inside for him and his consciousness that's the eternal part of him. Yes, that's the part real. That's going to, yeah, that's what's real. That's what's really real. And his physical self, his exterior, that is going to go away, mm-hmm. you know, for Harry, for all of us, that's going to go away. But if we cling and always foster that interior,
yes,
that is more, then we are eternal. We are part of the divine, you know, and that's such the core of the Christian yes. message as well, that we are invited into this, you know, divine life, if only we can foster that soul within us that is of God, you know. So yeah, so all of this like really pushes my buttons.
As a related question, Elizabeth, you actually suggest that some of these, you know, architectural structures are not even containers so much as they are gateways.
Absolutely.
I think this goes along with Emily's point too.
Yes.
So how do you see that? And, you know, what are we to take away from this idea that a sort of small exterior could actually be like a gateway to something?
Well, and I think that really ties in beautifully with what you said, Emily, the idea that a lot of it depends on what you want to see, what you want to experience. If you want to hang on to the physical and you can't get to that interior, you become like the dwarves in the last battle.
Mm-hmm.
Aslan's kingdom is open there before them. They've gone through the stable door, the tiny little stable, and now the entry point here for the stable door, and yet they don't see it. They refuse, and they literally say, they won't be taken in. And that's true. They won't be taken in, and they won't be taken out either. They won't be taken out of the prison they've created for themselves. So they just sit there all together in misery. They have made their own hell. And so that's what we as human beings can do if we refuse to acknowledge that the interior, that who we are on the inside is the important part, and that our soul is the thing that matters. And that of course, it's all happening inside our heads, but that, you know, that's the thing that's real. So there's that idea. And so the idea that those are gateways, they're not just things that carry stuff around, but they literally take our characters to a different place, a different space, a different reality. That really reinforces that idea that we experience that gateway. And of course, that's what, interestingly enough, and much less, not nearly as deep as the idea of our souls, but a book does that too. You have a book, it's just a small thing. Mm-hmm. I'm holding one here, it's paper and things. And yet we open that and we just fall right into this other world that is rich and complicated. And many of us, when we're reading books, I remember when Deathly Hallows first came out and my husband and I were chasing each other all around the house, like, you are, get out of there. You're reading again. It's my turn for the book. So because everybody's trying to get to the book. So the idea that we can use those, a book as a gateway, as a place to take us someplace, somewhere else, is certainly very familiar to those of us who are readers. But it also is that reminder that indeed, as you point out so beautifully, Emily, that we go through to someplace else that is much more real than the material world that surrounds us every day.
Yeah, and I know, Emily, you come from the Catholic tradition, but I've looked a little bit at Mircea Eliade, who's a philosopher who talks about not gateways so much as thresholds that take you from the mundane to the sacred, and that this is something that is intrinsically human and that humans practice through various religions and ceremonial rites and so on, as a way to bring ourselves to transcend this, this material world, and to see that there are these thresholds that exist even in our everyday life, so that like a stick, but in this sacred context, can become a threshold to the sacred, in a way that that uplifts it. And I was thinking about, when you've got a lot of the spaces that are thresholds, like the leaky cauldron, are kind of dirty and unkempt, and they don't look like they're exactly an elevation to a wonderful new world, right? And that's exactly a kind of manifestation of that idea that the mundane can be transformed into a threshold to this wider world.
And those liminal experiences, those in between places. I mean, that is when, you know, it's dusk and it's twilight. It's the time between times when the moon and the sun are opposite. Those are places that are deeply resonant for humans in a huge, you know, and throughout all different cultures. But certainly it's something that we see with literature, and definitely with these books and with other fantasy literature, that idea that, and we see that as Harry, we see it with the Vanishing Cabinet and even with the flu powder, the idea that you can almost see all those other places where you could stop. Mm-hmm. And it's very much like the wood between the worlds that Lewis uses in The Magician's Nephew. It's this sort of in-between place. It's neither here nor there. It's the crossroads. It's that place where you must decide, you must choose one way or the other.
King's Cross.
Yeah, King's Cross. And it is a cross. It is a crux. It is a place between places where you're in a position. And just for that moment, all the possibilities are open. But once you choose, you've chosen. Mm-hmm. And my students are too young now to remember those great old Choose Your Own Adventure books.
You know, they're still out there. They're still out there.
I love those. Yeah.
Or something. I don't know. But unless you're like me and you go through and you find all the horrible endings and you mark those pages and you make yourself a note, never go to page 76. You know,
Elizabeth, it's like we're the same person.
I hate the bad endings, man. I get them all figured out. And then, you know, then from my sort of narrative point of view, I would go back and construct the best possible. Okay, so if you make these choices, you get the best story. Here's the best story you can have. So if you want the most exciting story, but you still have a good ending, you know, you have all these different versions of the story. So those liminal spaces are those moments right before you turn to page 76 or wherever it is, you decide, okay, do we call the police or do we go inside the creepy house? What are we going to do? So that moment of decision has that sort of sense of the magical, of the numinous, because it has all the possibilities. It's all the places and all the times all at once.
Yeah, it's kind of agency and destiny at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm just interested in is, you know, your title is Muggle-worthy, which of course is that setting on Newt's suitcase. But I'm interested in this idea. I was thinking about this when you're talking about the dwarves, that like muggles are not going to have access to these gateways.
Right.
And so I just wonder what you think about that, like muggle-worthy, the muggle-worthiness of we're hiding the richness or the possibilities that are so wondrous.
Well, they do have access if somebody from the wizarding world takes them. And so, you know, Hermione's parents come into the wizarding world. Jacob comes into the wizarding world with Newt.
I love that, right? Oh, everybody gosh, loves yes, when he loves just, you. Yeah.
And he gets his wand for Christmas.
Yeah.
Or he says he does.
Yes,
perfect.
Perfect. So we have people who are muggles, or at least appear to be, who can enter that wizarding world, but they have to have someone take them. And so there's that definitely that spiritual level as well, we go and we take people by the hand and we lead them out of the muggle world, just as Lucy tries to get those poor dwarfs, but they don't listen. You know, we try to help. Sometimes we have to have somebody who already knows the way. If you don't know which bricks to hit to get out of the leaky cauldron into Diagon Alley, you're just going to be stuck in the leaky cauldron forever. And so there is that sense that how can we know unless someone tells us? How will they know unless someone is sent? You know, there is that idea that in order for people to see what's beyond the surface, someone has to show them that it's there.
I think about Hagrid saying you have to know where to go. There's already knowledge. Yeah.
It's all
now,
there.
I wonder, we've talked a little bit about this so far, but I wonder, like, what do you think, should we think about this, you know, these spaces that are bigger or that are somehow different from the exterior? Should we think about that as an illusion or should we think of that as a real manipulation of space? What do you think? I'm just wondering about like the reality of it. Is it deceptive? Is it real?
I think there's a real big difference between reality and truth, capital T truth. There's a wonderful old Appalachian storyteller that I always loved, Ray Hicks. He always used to say about the Jack Tales, he said, well, they ain't true, but there's a lot of truth in them. And I loved that. I always loved that about the story. And so the idea that the reality, the physical world is, it's tangible, it's tactile. We can touch it and feel it, but it is less capital R real. It's not real. You know, you think about like the Velveteen Rabbit kind of real, right? The real is what's going on underneath. The real is what we can't see. That's the real. And we think about that. We actually, if we're honest, that's everyday life as well. I mean, how many times have we gone back to that elementary school, you know, and we realized, oh, that's not what that looked like at all. But the way I remembered it was this.
Right.
Or if we have an experience in our feelings and our, you know, and we acknowledge that as humans that, you know, my feelings were hurt by that. Well, that's not what was intended. Well, that's what happened. And so sometimes the facts, you know, there are facts and then there are, then there's truth. And so sometimes those aren't always the same thing. And so it's really an interesting thing for us as humans and something I think that we're all in the process of trying to unpack throughout our lives all the time about what's real. And is it just real in terms of its physical manifestation, or is it real in terms of our experience and our understanding? And maybe, and sometimes I think the one that's the experience understanding is more valid for us than just the things we see around us.
Yeah, I always think about it in terms of transcendence and having a transcendent experience.
Absolutely.
Right. We're here. We're material and we are made to seek these things through the material world. And yet they really occur, you know, interiorly.
Yes.
And again, it makes perfect sense that you need a guide, you know, because to touch the transcendent, you first have to acknowledge that you are not it, you know, and that something more is needed than just you and yourself and your own ingenuity, you know. So, yes. Of course, it starts with a guide, but then that guide is going to lead you on a path where you can, you know, experience the divine in some way and your participation in the divine. And so, you know, it's just, it is all about that kind of being able to transcend that mundane or muggle world, you know, to touch this more magical, this transcendent reality.
And Emily, you were mentioning that you think in within the Harry Potter series, this idea that Harry starts from a cupboard.
Yes.
Yes. You want to talk about your idea?
Yeah. I mean, as I was concluding reading Elizabeth's chapter, I just thought, you know, this is an epic, epic story, right? Mm-hmm. It's 7 books. It's just this such a huge story, you know, with Harry as the central hero. And yet he begins, you know, we meet him. He's in this cupboard under the stairs and he's closeted, you know, and in this very confined space, just him and the spiders. And he comes out of that into this epic narrative. And I just thought it was something that really reinforces a lot of the themes that you were talking about on a big scale.
And it's that same kind of wonderful thing that I love talking about a lot in this chapter was this idea of nesting, of things like being nested inside one another.
Yes.
I have a couple of different nesting dolls in my office that a student brought me. And I love using them as illustrations to show how all these things are kind of enclosed, which is how the universe works. If we think about our cells and how complicated they are, and then they're inside our bodies and we're inside the earth and, you know, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's just so amazing. But we have this idea in the books that we have Harry, he's in that cupboard, and then he goes out into this larger world. And then, and I love when we have things like the tent with all the stuff in it inside Hermione's little bitty bag, or we have all the weirdness with the Niffler, when the Niffler can have Newt's case inside its pouch,
or the Niffler
can be inside the box. Well,
mind-blowing.
It's kind of blue. And then it's all enclosed inside these books, and it's all enclosed inside our heads while we're reading. So it's this like, oh, it really is fun to think about all the different wonderful layers and the way that can kind of bend our minds a little bit.
Yeah, and we haven't even talked about Doctor Who. No. The TARDIS.
No, I know.
Right?
Absolutely. And that's a whole other conversation, which I considered, and it's like, I'm just not going to open that one.
Yeah.
I'm just going to leave that TARDIS door closed.
Leave that alone.
So, yeah, I think we've been talking a lot about this. I think we can see some of this already, but this theme of bigger on the inside than it looks on the outside is just really popular in fantasy series. And, you know, why do you think that is, Elizabeth? Like, why do we keep coming back to it?
Well, because the whole idea of the numinous, of the fantasy, of the, you know, non-realistic kind of fiction, is that there's more. There's more. It is not just this Okay, Emily, I'll do it again. We're more than just this crude matter. We'll bring in Yoda there.
Yes.
There's so much more. And that is the beautiful thing that is so pretty and so much fantasy that does have the Christian tradition built into it. And so that idea that there's beauty, there's goodness, there's so much more than what we see around us. And it's worth looking for. But even any kind of fantasy is this idea that this could be more than a stick. What if it is a magic wand? And that's something that we have as children. Children always see the possibilities. They are mm-hmm. never daunted by the fact that their shorts pockets are small, Katie. They're going to keep cramming stuff in there.
Right.
I wrote a poem one time that about things I missed in the wash, about the stuff that has shown up in my dryer over the years that was in people's pockets, and how it changes over time. You know, you go from the rocks, and then there's the Legos, and then later it's like gum, you know. It's like
oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then the sad part later on, when none of those things are in there anymore in your pockets, aww, that's sad. That's the sad part. Mm-hmm. But the idea that as human beings, as children, we are always seeing possibilities. We always see, well, what if that house down the street, as we see in The Magician's Nephew, that Polly's father says the reason the one house isn't rented out is because there's something wrong with the plumbing. She's like, that's really boring. Grown-ups always come up with like boring explanations for things. Maybe it's a smuggler's hideout and all these kinds of things. So kids always come up with the cooler explanations, the more mm-hmm. fun things, the more interesting things. And so we outgrow that, sadly. And so fantasy is always about that continued need. Fantasy literature is to continue to that, as you said, that innocence, that seeking that children find so natural and that we have to work at as we get older, that whether it's, and it's because sometimes we have been disappointed by people. They turned out to be just as terrible as we thought they would be, or, you know, they turned out to disappoint us or let us down, or the job we thought was great turned out not to be great, or that the house we thought would be wonderful was not. The disappointments tend to pile up a little bit on us. And so sometimes we have to work a little bit more to say there are good things that you just can't see, and that things have those possibilities.
Yeah.
But I think that's part of the appeal of all fantasy, is that there's more to it. And there is something interesting that we can look for beyond what we can see with and what we can touch.
That's so beautiful. I really loved your chapter in The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond. And
same.
I would just encourage everyone to get yourself a copy of this. There's so many wonderful essays.
Yes.
And I will say that Emily and I also have some essays in there.
Yes, thank you.
Should you be interested? Actually, Elizabeth and I are in the same section.
Yeah.
Because we're kind of similarly dealing with some of these ideas about the hidden, you know, mm-hmm. the things that are not so obvious that the wizarding world is trying to bring to our attention. Well, Elizabeth, what is next for you, or what are some projects that you've been working on? I know I always love your Harry Potter stuff, but I know that you just work in all kinds of different areas of literature. So what you up to?
Oh, it's so much fun. I always feel like I'm being pulled into things. It's like, I didn't even know that was an opportunity. I have a couple of great C.S. Lewis opportunities that are coming up that I'm really looking forward to. I got to do some podcasts, the Great Books podcast. I got to do that with the Narnia series that they did on there. I got to do The Silver Chair last year. That was really fun. And then I got to do Till We Have Faces this year, which was fabulous. And
what a book, Till We Have Faces.
Gosh.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
That's my favorite of Lewis's. It's hard to say. I mean, I can't really, it's like choosing a child, right? You can't differentiate. But of his non-Narnia books, probably Till We Have Faces is my favorite of his non-Narnia fiction. It's just, I love it. And it's so meaningful. So I really enjoy talking about that one. And I'm getting to work on a program that I'm doing on The Great Divorce, which is really fun. I haven't gotten to spend a lot of time with that one before. And then I'm doing a chapter on The Weight of Glory for another collection. And I have some Star Trek stuff coming up next year, which is fun because it's just kind of like, I just can't get away from Star Trek. It's kind of fun. it's not that I necessarily want to, but it's just, it's like, wow, all these fun things just come and find me. But it's always a joy. And I have some Hunger Games stuff I'm working on too still that I love working with that. And always with Harry Potter, with Rowling, we've got a new Strike book coming out next year. So that'll be a good time. Lots of things out there. There's always something interesting and always mm-hmm. something right around the corner. We just never know what will be there when you open that cupboard door.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, gosh, I look forward to reading all of that, and I'm gonna go listen to the podcast Until We Have Faces, because I want to hear all your thoughts on that. Thank you so much, Elizabeth Baird Hardy, for joining us on the show today.
Oh, thank you both so much for having me. This has been an absolute joy, because as academics, sometimes getting to talk about Harry Potter and getting to chat with you is very much like going out the back of the leaky cauldron and getting to go someplace magical. So thank you. I have to go back to the Muggle world now, but I am rejuvenated. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, no, me too. I mean, this is why I love doing it. I just love this wonderful conversation. This is exactly why I love to do this podcast.
Yes.
We're going to close today with a quote from Gellert Grindelwald. So I don't think I've ever done a Gellert Grindelwald quote before, but this is when he was masquerading as Percival Graves in the first Fantastic Beasts film, and he said, "You're an interesting man, Mr. Scamander. Just like your suitcase, I think there's more to you than meets the eye."
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to pottervercitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes, and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.